Hello and welcome to Poet's Corner. I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Rexy. Today I'll be reading the funny poetry of Richard Armour, A-R-M-O-U-R. He was born in 1906 and lived until 1989. Richard Armour was an American author, poet, and humorist, best known for his satirical works on historical figures and events. He published over 40 books, including popular titles like It All Started with Columbus, Twisted Tales from Shakespeare, and the classics Reclassified. Armour's writing was skillfully blended with factual information and comedic twists, creating entertaining and accessible narratives that appeal to a wide audience. I was first introduced to Armour's work by my high school English teacher, and I remember that we all laughed and laughed. Although his work was primarily published in the mid-20th century, Armour's take on history continues to entertain readers today. His ability to find humor in the everyday things of life while maintaining respect for the accuracy makes his writing timeless and appealing to those seeking both entertainment and knowledge. I didn't know he had written poetry until very recently. Today, I'll start with To Have and Too Old. The bride, white of hair, is stooped over her cane. Her faltering footsteps need guiding. While down the church aisle, with wan, toothless smile, the groom in a wheelchair comes riding. And who is this elderly couple, you ask? You'll find when you've closely explored it that they're here is that rare, most conservative pair who waited till they could afford it. Good sportsmanship. Good sportsmanship we hail, we sing. It's always pleasant when you spot it. There's only one unhappy thing. You have to lose to prove you've got it. Parental pride. My day-old son is plenty scrawny. His mouth is wide with screams or yawny. His ears seem larger than he's needing. His nose is flat. His chin's receding. His skin is very, very red. He has no hair upon his head. And yet, I'm proud as proud can be to hear you say, he looks like me. My mattress and I. Night after night for years on end, my mattress has been my closest friend. My mattress and I are cozy and pally. There are hills on the sides. I sleep in the valley. It clearly reveals the shape I'm in. Where I'm thin, it's thick. Where it's thick, I'm thin. Its contours reflect the first and the last of me. It's very nearly a plaster cast of me. I miss my mattress when I'm gone. It's the one thing I've made an impression on. The next two poems are serious and sweet. This is called One Small Sun, S-O-N. One small hand to hold in yours. One small face to smile. One wet kiss as he says goodnight. One small child. Catch the moment and put it in your heart. The years too soon will fly. These are precious moments, more than money can buy. Two small arms to hold you tight. Two small feet to run. Two small eyes full of love for you. One small sun. Catch the moment and put it in your heart and never let it go. Save it for the years to come when he too will know. One small hand to hold his. one small face to smile, one small kiss as she says good night, one small child. Numbers game. One runner's safe, one runner's out, or so the ump has beckoned. The one who's safe touched second first. The one who's out first second. My food grows colder. Please don't get up, she said to me while pausing at my table. But I got up so that she could see I'm courteous and able. She little knew that when I sup, good manners I am blind to. For till she said, please don't get up, it hadn't crossed my mind to. And now some quatrains, four lines, very short. Congress. Politics, it seems to me, for years or all too long, has been concerned with right or left instead of right or wrong. Logic. If you convinced me and I convinced you, would there not still be two points of view? Economics. That money talks, I'll not deny. I heard it once. It said, goodbye. Libraries. Here is where people, one frequently finds, lower their voices and raise their minds. A fly swatter. The hand is quicker than the eye is, but somewhat slower than the fly is. Condiments 1. Shake and shake the ketchup bottle. None will come, and then a lot'll. Condiments 2. Nothing attracts the mustard from Wiener's as much as the slacks just back from the cleaners. Late riser. Daybreak, it said, when night is ended. I stay in bed until it's mended. Poetry. That poem is a splendid thing. I love to hear you quote it. I like the thought. I like the swing. I like it all. I wrote it. Teamwork. A splendid team, my wife and I. She washes dishes and I dry. I sometimes pass her back a dish to give another cleansing swish. She sometimes holds up to the light a glass I haven't dried just right. But mostly there is no complaint, or it is courteous and faint, for I would never care to see the washing job consigned to me. And though the things I dry still drip, she keeps me for companionship. There's a quotation at the beginning of this poem. And to warm every poet's heart, here is Armour's response to W.J. Alden, who had written, how can I know what I think till I see what I say? How could the poet possibly know till the very last word in the very last row? For a poem's a word plus a word plus a word, added, subtracted, and thoroughly stirred. And thought makes the word, and the word makes thought, and some things come that were never sought. At what he has said, when his said is done, the poet's surprised as anyone. Our guests. Our guests are about to go. The signs, it is true, are small, but the sensitive host and hostess know they'll soon be out in the hall. Our guests are about to go. That is, they're all set to start, to plan, to prepare, to get ready, to begin to commence to depart. Down the tube. I've seen my wife with anger burn at something that I never learn. The toothpaste tube I squeeze and bend at top and middle, not the end. She scolds me, pointing out my error, makes use of scorn, and taunts my terror. But I forget and go on squeezing the toothpaste tube in ways displeasing. In larger things we are convivial. What causes trouble is the trivial. Well, come in. You can have your welcome mats. I ask for just a little more when I come home from work, and that's a welcome mate inside my door. Pachycephalosaurus. Among the later dinosaurs, though not the largest, strongest, Pachycephalosaurus had the name that was the longest. Yet he had more than syllables, as you may well suppose. He had great knobs upon his cheeks and spikes upon his nose. 10 inches thick, atop his head, a bump of bone projected. By this his brain, though hardly worth protecting, was protected. No claw or tooth, no tree that fell upon his head, kerwacky, could crack or crease or jar or scar that stony part of Packy. And so he nibbled plants in peace and lived untroubled days. Sometimes, in fact, as Packy proved, to be a bonehead pays. These poems include complaints about rock and roll. There's this about the teenage crowd. They like their music good and loud. And I'm not hep. I lack the knack. It sends me, but I don't come back. And complaints about the indifference of some offspring toward their parents. He's a four-letter man at college, we hear. That's the number of times he writes home each year. This poem would surely ruffle the feathers of many contemporary readers. One such example is called Pulling No Punches. What an awful beating kids would get, the thought allures. If you could whale the neighbor's brats, and they could punish yours. And I'll close with reading a passage from Richard Armour's book called Twisted Tales from Shakespeare. Romeo and Juliet. Introduction. The plot of Romeo and Juliet came to England from Italy through France, arriving tired and dusty and covered with hotel stickers. Passed from person to person by word of mouth, it picked up interesting details and several of the more popular diseases of the 16th century. As with most of Shakespeare's work, scholars believe this also was preceded by a lost play. Elizabethans never could remember where they left things. Romeo and Juliet is one of Shakespeare's early works. Microscopic examination of the first quarto reveals no trace of hair and leads to the assumption that the play was written before Shakespeare grew a beard. It unquestionably, even indubitably, belongs to that period of Shakespeare's life when he was experimenting with lyricism. The verse has a fluid quality, purple splotches being interspersed with brown puddles where the author gave way to his weakness for liquid syllables. The style in general is marked by numerous figures of speech, metaphors, semaphores, tongue twisters, etc. An occasional wordy passage is set off by a passage of equal length in which Shakespeare strips his language bare and uses no words whatsoever. The stark simplicity of these latter passages beggars description. Shakespeare represents the love of Romeo and Juliet as that of two young people caught in the coils of fate and unable to help themselves. In that hot Italian summer, passions were high and shirts were damp. Both of the lovers grow in stature as the story unfolds, until by the last act, Romeo stands well over 6 feet in his sandals, and Juliet has to let down the hem of her kirtle. At the beginning of the play, Romeo and Juliet are callow and impetuous. By the end of the play, they are noble, dignified, and dead. Romeo and Juliet has long been one of the most popular of Shakespeare's plays, enjoyed especially by young people who identify themselves with the two lovers, and by poets who identify themselves with Shakespeare. The balcony scene has been played all over the world, except possibly in regions where there are only one-story houses. If the part of Juliet has sometimes overshadowed that of Romeo, it is because Romeo spends so much time under the balcony. And now Romeo and Juliet, a family feud. The play opens with a prologue which tells the whole story and makes it unnecessary to go any further. It seems that in the Italian city of Verona, a feud is going on between the Montagues and the Capulets, it being the height of the feudal period. What made the Montagues mad at the Capulets and vice versa is not explained. Evidently, it's something that happened so long ago that nobody can remember, like Yale and Harvard. Anyhow, there's no feud like an old feud, and no one likes to upset a tradition. Since the Montagues and the Capulets carry swords and fight at the drop of a pizza, those red spots on the pavement really are blood. Hot-headed young fellows are always running swords through each other. "Draw!" they shout, which is the signal to pull their swords out of each other and look to see who made the larger hole. Aeschylus, the prince of Verona, is getting sick of all this bloodshed. Every time someone is killed, he loses a taxpayer. "What ho, you men, you beasts!" he cries, making sure to include everyone. He warns Montague and Capulet that this brawling has to stop, or they will forfeit their own lives. This puts a new complexion on things. Romeo meets Juliet. Romeo, the son of Montague, is a handsome young fellow who is in an advanced stage of love sickness for a girl named Rosalind. He sighs all day long and is getting short of breath. At night, he can hardly wait to get to sleep so he can start dreaming, but Rosalind cares for him not a whit. Hoping to make him forget Rosalind, two swashbuckling friends of his, Benvolio and Mercutio, persuade him to crash a party at the Capulets. since Romeo and Benvolio are Montagues, they don masks, hoping to be mistaken for burglars. Old Capulet's daughter, Juliet, is the most luscious damsel at the party. When Romeo casts eyes on her, she playfully tosses them back. He feels an electric shock run through him, even though the place is lit by torches, and forgets Rosalind completely. It seems she hangs upon the cheek of night like a rich jewel in an Ethiop's ear, remarks Romeo, who is a quick man with a simile, no matter how ridiculous. In a short while, he has made her acquaintance, and before the evening is over, has worked up to a kiss. "You kiss by the book," Juliet comments. Seems she has read the same how-to opus and recognizes the system. She puckers up again, ready to move on to the next chapter. Tybalt, a young Capulet who hates the Montague's guts, which he is always spilling into the gutter, recognizes Romeo by the way he smacks his lips. "Fetch me my rapier, boy," he says to his caddy, passing up his broadsword and his eight-iron. He is about to run Romeo through when he is stopped by old Capulet. "Let him alone," Capulet says brusquely. Then, when Tybalt starts to argue, he shouts, "Go to!" Tybalt goes, although his destination is unspecified. At last, Julia's mother calls her, and Juliet withdraws. Later that night, Romeo learns from Benvolio that Juliet is a Capulet, and Juliet learns from her nanny that Romeo is a Montague. "I love a loathed enemy," says Juliet, who is only 14 and a crazy mixed-up Capulet. As for Romeo, despite all that osculation, he's none too sure of himself. After all, Juliet has never seen him without his mask on. Romeo goes back for more. Later that night, Romeo gives his friends the slip and climbs over the wall into the Capulet's orchard. "Leaps the wall," the text says, but Shakespeare was inclined to exaggerate. He has a wonderful chance to purloin some fruit, but passes it up when he sees Juliet standing on her bedroom balcony in her negligee, looking negligected. At sight of her, Romeo goes slightly daft, mumbling about putting her eyes in the sky and replacing them with stars, probably two of the smaller ones. "Oh, that I were a glove upon that hand, that I might touch that cheek," he exclaims, getting more and more impractical. Juliet, who has an extraordinary sense of smell, realizes that Romeo is in the vicinity. "Oh, Romeo, Romeo," probably a misreading of "A Romeo, a Romeo," she cries out. "Wherefore art thou, Romeo? Wherefore art thou at?" And then, lest he take offense, she hastily adds, "A rose by any other name would smell as sweet." As Romeo gazes hungrily at her, Juliet becomes embarrassed. "Thou knowest the mask of night is on my face," she explains, chagrined at being caught with her cold cream on. But in the pale moonlight, Romeo seems not to have noticed this. They converse until almost morning, Juliet leaning from her balcony and Romeo pacing around underneath. At last she retires chilled to the bone, and Romeo goes home with a crick in his neck. This Romeo and Juliet passage is from Richard Armour's book, Twisted Tales from Shakespeare. Thank you for listening to Poets' Corner. as we shared the wit and humor of writer Richard Armour. I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Rexy. Remember, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.